Welcome to episode 4 of the Marvel Us podcast. I'm your host, Tom Laurie, with my sister,
Leona Laurie.
And this week, we'll be talking about From 2002, directed by Sam Raimi, starring Tobey Maguire and Willem Dafoe and Kirsten Dunst and
James Franco.
Spider-Man. What'd you think of Spider-Man?
Well, Tom, I thought it was kind of boring.
Really? But,
I guess I didn't not enjoy it.
Yeah, it was very, all right.
Yes!
Like,
it was all right.
It was very earnest. Like, that was the thing that really struck me. Like, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about Spider-Man 2 in retrospect in that sort of tone, like, about how sincere and earnest that movie is. I think that's very true of this one as well, but also that's kind of, I don't know, like, the stakes feel kind of dull, the conflicts, like, I don't know. I mean, I think Willem Dafoe is the Norman Osborn / the villain, the Green Goblin, and I think he's really good as a villain. He's very creepy, but also can do the whole sort of stern fatherly thing enough to be like, it's not just creepy Willem Dafoe. Like, you could buy him as a normal human being as well.
He has a range of expressions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of those expressions is very creepy Goblin Man, which, I mean, despite the mask that's usually on his face through a good portion of the movie, he works with it well.
Before you move away from it, though, I want to say that earnest is exactly the word that I was thinking while we were watching it, because when we talk about the, you know, Wonder Woman excluded, but the current DC fare and how self-serious it is, while I was watching this, I was thinking, it's not as much fun as the modern Marvel movies, but I don't think I'd call it too self-serious. It's a little self-serious, but what it is earnest. They do that whole I'm a bummer loner thing a bit, but if I remember Spider-Man 2 well enough, I know that they'll address that, but it's very earnest. It's very straightforward about what it is.
I think the bummer loner stuff also works a little better in the context just because he's such a dork. Like, it's easy to imagine a character, at least this depiction of Peter Parker, you know, not being particularly good at handling these situations and wanting to recoil, like, taking everything as seriously and feeling as put upon and alone as he does, especially in the era. Like, one of the things I thought was he's very emo, and I think that is very fitting for a 2002 movie of him being so dramatic and worried about his own circumstance.
Yeah, agreed.
Did you want to talk about where Spider-Man came from at all?
You mean, like, the origin of within the movie, or you mean the origin of the character in the background of it?
A little both, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah,
As far as superheroes we've covered so far, I think the Spider-Man we get is very close to the Spider-Man that exists. Like, the big difference, the thing that people held up the most, was that this Spider-Man isn't really as funny as Spider-Man tends to be. There were some lines that felt like they were kind of supposed to be quippy, but I think Tobey Maguire is just too much of a dork. Like,
well, he's very earnest.
Yeah, yes. There are some lines that seem like they're, you know, they're kind of punny, kind of jokey, but it all is so earnest that it's like, man, this guy is such a dork. But the webs, Spider-Man is typically supposed to have devices that shoot chemical web stuff that he makes himself. And in this, they kind of just want to sideline that a bit and just be like, nah, he just naturally has natural occurring webs.
That was a surprise to me when he's like, has sticky hands and has stuff shooting out of his wrists. So I was like, oh, I forgot that they gave him, like, spider characteristics beyond the ones that, you know, you typically think of.
Yeah. On the one hand, I think that kind of takes away from him as a science genius, That's something they only vaguely hint at this. They're way more into him as the photojournalist aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed there was a very small offhand comment about him.
There were a few.
Right, but like something, his like class with Dr. Connors or something. That is the one-armed scientist who, in different circumstances and in The Amazing Spider-Man, would become the Doc Lizard.
Oh, the Lizard.
Trying to cook up some sort of serum that would help him regrow his arm, like lizards regrow their tails. He turns into a lizard monster instead.
Okay.
Other than the biological webs, Spider-Man you get is pretty much the Spider-Man that has always been. Like, started in 1962, Stan Lee, like a lot of characters credited to Stan Lee, he was like, here's a vague idea that's probably stolen from someone else. Go make it into a comic book, Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko. And then those guys come up with all of the details that wind up being iconic. Like, Jack Kirby, I think, gave him a gun that shoots webs. And Stan Lee did not like any of the stuff he came up with. So he went to Steve Ditko and was like, hey, make this guy a teenager and a little, you know, more unruly like a teen. And that's where the iconic Spider-Man costume and the web shooters and him wearing a mask so that people would not know that he was just a teen would all come into play.
Okay.
So now to the plot of the movie itself.
All right. So.
That didn't sound very enthusiastic.
Well, the plot felt so...
It's kind of hard to... Well, that's that sort of thing. It's so hard to look back at now when not only have you seen 3 movies of this guy, but 2 more movies that retread a lot of this same territory, and beyond that, everyone just already knows who Spider-Man is. Like, it's so difficult for any of this to feel... That was something I kept thinking about through this was this a cliche when it happened this time, or is it just now that all of this has been done so many other times in other Spider-Man movies, but also so many other times in other superhero movies, that in hindsight, I'm projecting the cliche onto this thing that might have popularized whatever superhero stuff?
I don't know. I think it's a mix, because, like, the Spider-Man origin story, I think everybody knows, but, you know, I didn't... Like, I watched the cartoon a little bit, but this is the first cinema version of that. And so when that happened, when I saw it in the theater, I feel like... I think you made an allusion a minute ago to the stakes being kind of lukewarm in this. And I think that's what I felt the first time I saw it. It wasn't that I disliked anybody. It was just that it's hard to care. Like, you know that Spider-Man's going to win. And you know that Uncle Ben's gonna die. Like, there's a lot about it. And one of the things we were talking about while we were watching it was, in the new Spider-Man movie, the one that Marvel is actually behind, they skipped all this stuff. And it was so refreshing just to come in on him having adventures instead of watching Uncle Ben die again and watching him discover his powers again and get bit by a spider again. Mm-hmm. When it feels like, okay, we know that part. And so... I think they're smart in the new one not to do the stuff we already know, because sometimes it's charming to see a dramatization, like to see it brought to life in a new way, this thing that you already know. But in this case, some of it was charming. I would say not all, that he's a high school dork, that Mary Jane is the girl he's loved since he was 6, that he has, in this movie, one friend, Rich Harry, who has the... rich Norman Osborn dad, who becomes the Green Goblin, but is a military contractor and scientist before that. And he goes on a field trip to a lab full of radioactive spiders.
Not radioactive in this. They're, that's the difference as well, is that instead of radioactive spiders, it's genetically engineered spiders.
One of them bites him. It gives him superpowers. It doesn't die. There are 14 others. No one mentions
that was something that I was like, man, this feels like it should have been set up for something. Like,
yeah.
There's potentially 14 other Spider-Man
origins. Because one that bites him just goes and crawls under something.
I mean, it crawls under something. You could assume that spider gets stepped on at some point. But even then, like, yes, it seems like there's so many other of these magic spiders for that, and not only to not ever come up in this movie, but in two more movies to never be touched upon was
nobody's weird. Like, you know what? One of our spiders escaped, and shortly after, a man dressed exactly like it started swinging through the city. Oh, where's that spider? Like, you know, there's none of that. But anyway, so that happens. Then he gets all buff the next morning and doesn't need glasses. His doting aunt never notices that he is not using his expensive prescription lenses anymore. He beats up Joe Manganiello.
Right, Joe Manganiello is Flash Thompson.
Who is dating MJ at the high school.
For some reason, I think it must have been Amazing Spider-Man. I've only seen the first of those two movies, but I remember so little of it that I have to assume that whatever their depiction of Flash Thompson was overwrit my memories of Joe Manganiello's Flash, because he's such, like, I don't know, he seems like such a Jersey douchebag in this. It felt way more authentic than I remembered it feeling. Because, you know, typically Flash is like, oh, I'm the, you know, Aryan jock jerk face, like a very old sort of archetype of the big man on campus kind of deal. And this Flash felt like, oh yeah, I could imagine this guy being a real guy and sucking, but still also being, you know, popular in a high school in 2002.
I think part of why you didn't remember him is that he's barely in it, though, too. Like, to the point where I didn't remember anything about him being in this, and...
But the memories I did have were of, like, a super blonde white guy being the rich guy, not Joe Manganiello, like, with, you know, gelled up hair and a Plymouth Prowler.
Oh my gosh. You know, for a guy who I described after seeing Magic Mike 2 as a national treasure... I was not seeing that in this guy.
A curious beginning for him.
You know what, though? More power to guys or girls. Anybody, like, think about Marissa Tomei in the new one. More power to people who get sexier as they get older.
Mm.
You know, that's what I'm doing. So, anyway, they graduate from high school. Uncle Ben is dead, as usual. Wrestling leads to the...
glossed over the wrestling, where Uncle Ben gets killed by, again, another... marker of 2002, a balding man with bleached spiked hair robs the amateur wrestling is something I'm pretty sure that is a hallmark of Spider-Man's origins, and the Uncle Ben getting killed scenario of him being like, oh, I want to make some money, so I'm going to go do this amateur. I can't remember if that's actually a comic thing or if that's something crafted for the movie. Either way, the late Macho Man Randy Savage plays Bonesaw, and Spider-Man gets roped into a cage match with him. And all of this, I'm like, wrestling is, like, everyone knows wrestling is super scripted and fake. What scenario does this sort of wrestling exist where a bunch of people just line up to go get thrown into actual steel bars by Macho Man Randy Savage and potentially actually paralyzed for the chance at $3,000, like, it's such a, I mean, I'm not going to question the veracity of Spider-Man as a historical text, but it seems a little weird.
Yes, it does, Tom. I agree with you about that. I had a point to make about it, too. Oh, yeah. I would like it if we referred to the robber who robs the wrestling match after Peter gets stiffed on his $3,000. And then Peter lets him escape, like, take that, douchey wrestling guy who stiffed me. And then that guy goes and kills Uncle Ben, scarring Peter for life, and is Guy Fieri. So that's what I would like us to call him now.
Guy Fieri origins.
That's the look. That's the look that guy is rocking. Guy Fieri.
Rascal Flatts himself.
Oh my gosh.
The irony they want you to take away from that scene is that Spider-Man has a chance to stop this mugger, slash robber, slash...
Carjacker,
but because he got stiffed by the wrestling promoter, he lets the guy go, and then that guy, once free, just goes and kills Uncle Ben and steals his car. They want you to take that away as the irony, but what I took away was Spider-Man went to do this amateur wrestling thing to make $3,000 to buy a car, and now his family has zero cars because his car got stolen and crashed.
Well, huh. You flipped the script there, Tom.
Well, I hope Spider-Man learned his lesson to
Yeah, he did.
Stop muggers whenever he can and appreciate that his family already owns a car.
Anyway, he goes off to the big city because now then he graduates from high school and he's all sad about how his uncle's dead. And he cries like, I don't know, it looked... I don't know how many takes they did of Tobey Maguire crying alone in his room, but it looked really weird to me. Like,
well, it's that kind of crying you see sometimes. Well, it's a weird kind of crying where it's like most of your face isn't doing the crying, but your eyes are like watering heavily. Like it could be an allergic reaction as much as an emotional state.
Like an onion cry.
Right.
Yeah, so he cries alone, Aunt May sees him, and then he moves to the city because he's pretty cavalier about Aunt May being a lonely old widow and doesn't seem to realize that his grief would affect her as well. Like, she's also sad. He's like, bye!
Well, why stick around with your crusty old aunt when you can move into a sweet-ass loft with your rich friend and have an awful chair made of cowhide?
Yes. So he and Harry get a giant loft in Manhattan, and MJ goes and works as a waitress, secretly starts dating Harry. Rather, Harry keeps it a secret. She and Flash have broken up because of who knows what. It happened silently. And then
there was some slight dialogue to it. When she's breaking up with Flash, she gives him back his class ring, and he's like, whatever.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. Ugh. It was a very, very Joe Manganiello as Flash moment. It all felt very true, but yeah, the depiction of Mary Jane kind of bothers me throughout this trilogy, but particularly here where it's like she says her dream is to become an actress on Broadway, and we only see her going to auditions once, and she comes out complaining that she didn't get this job on
a soap opera,
and the casting director told her she needed to take acting lessons, and she acts like not only is that a huge insult, but an extra huge insult coming from a soap opera casting director, and it's like, you literally just graduated from high school, you probably should be taking some sort of acting courses. You and I were both in high school drama, and I know neither of us were particularly invested in becoming, you know, entertainment professionals, actors of any sort, but I think, at least in my experience, there were a handful of kids who were, and they were huge dorks about it, but were also like, as soon as we graduate, we're probably going to NYU or moving to Hollywood, like, you know, doing some very concrete thing of like, I'm going to further educate myself towards some sort of acting degree or, you know, get into the union, something that actually says like, I'm really trying to be an actor and not, like, just complaining about it a lot and being a waitress.
Everybody I know who is an actor takes some kind of craft honing classes whenever they're not working. So, yeah, they're, like, in improv or dance or acting classes. It's something that all of them do. And so, yes, that hit me as very false as well. Like, you're 18, you're in New York City. Why are you embarrassed about being a waitress while you're trying to get your acting?
Yeah, that's like the most typical thing.
That's the thing.
Like,
yeah.
The stereotype.
My rich boyfriend would think it's low. Yeah, she's very problematic.
And apparently he would. Yeah. He also sucks.
Yeah. Anyway, Green Goblin happens. He figures out who Spider-Man is. They fight. The end. I don't know. I don't want to go through the plot anymore. I didn't mean to get that detailed about it. You can say more about the plot if you want to.
I mean, I took a lot of notes, but I don't know how much of it was interesting.
Did you write something down that I said? Was it interesting?
You didn't say that much.
You told me to save it for the podcast,
right.
So I stopped talking.
Yeah, now you don't want to talk anymore during the podcast.
No, I just don't want to get all detailed about the plot. I want to talk about the movie without going through the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't care about going through the whole thing either. I mean,
okay,
I'm sure everyone's
Let's
seen
talk
it.
Let's talk about the stuff that we want to talk about then.
What do you want to talk about?
That wet t-shirt scene.
Where... It's iconic, the upside down kiss.
Oh my gosh, like, I remember not...
The hard nips and the upside down kiss.
I was not as... invested in my identity as a feminist when this movie came out. Like, you know, I was younger. It was a different time. I was more naive. I wasn't as sensitive to that scene as I was today. But she's like, oh, Peter, flirty, flirty in the street. I don't know you're Spider-Man, even though it's super obvious to me, especially that you're Spider-Man. And he's like, oh, I'm not Spider-Man. And then she's like, okay, bye, I'm walking off by myself into the dark city in a really sketchy neighborhood. And he's like, I'm going to let you do that and just stand here. What? Sketchy guys are following you. And so she goes into a dark alley. It starts raining. And all her clothes fall off. Like, these four guys come out of nowhere and surround her. And somehow, during the scuffle, she loses everything except for this, like, flesh-colored slip dress that she's wearing. And I was like, I forgot what a rockin' figure she has. She has giant tits. I can see them right now. They're on display because she's basically in a wet t-shirt contest. And she's getting like, oh, I'm the damsel in distress. And then here comes Spider-Man. He beats up all the guys. And then he hangs upside down from a building. She takes off the bottom half of his mask and kisses him. And at the time, that was like sweet. But watching it this time, I was like, oh, that kind of upside down kissing is gross. Like, it's the kind of thing you do, like, if you're lying down and somebody is, like, standing over you and they kiss you. And then you're like, well, I like the gesture, but now your chin's in my nose. And I feel like it should have googly eyes on it. Like,
it's a PG-13-69.
It's a super weird kiss. It's like an awkward thing. And they did it for so long in the rain while she's wearing nothing. And is soaked. Like, every single thing about that scene should have been making one or the other of them visibly uncomfortable. I could not roll with it.
The extra thing I love about that is at the end, after they have their unmasked real people kiss at Norman's funeral, then as he's walking away dramatically, she realizes, oh, that's a familiar kiss. Now, like, really? Would you recognize a right-side-up kiss compared to that upside-down kiss?
Maybe if he has a particular taste.
Maybe if he has a pierced tongue.
Maybe if he has really, like, distinct coffee breath, and she's like, yuck, I've tasted that before. Spider-Man had the same gross breath.
Or maybe he's a really bad kisser in a very particular way.
Yeah, she's like, wait, my face is coated with slime now. That's familiar. Only it's on the other side of my face this time, because he's right-side-up. Oh, I guess it would be the same side. She was right side up both times.
The other thing I thought was very silly about that scene is, like, I mean, first off, there's this really sort of popular webcomic that makes its rounds occasionally, fan art of Spider-Man walking a woman home at night and just sort of a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man thing to do. And he doesn't do that. But also, the two guys who stalk Mary Jane into the alley, it's like, that seems like a believable enough scenario. But then when she gets into the alley and two more guys leap out from the shadows, it's like, did these guys all plan this? Because it seemed like the first two guys were doing this very impromptu of like, yeah. Oh, hey, check out this hot babe we can go harass or rob or whatever. And then these other guys just hiding in the shadows in the alley waiting for something. I don't. It was extremely strange all around.
Yeah, that scene was problematic. Another scene that I had problems with this time, that didn't strike me as much when I saw it the original time. They're on their spider field trip. The escaped spider is hovering up in the eaves in its web. And he's like, Mary Jane, let me take pictures of you for the school paper. And then for like a half an hour, she's making poses in front of all of these genetically modified spiders except one, because one is missing and nobody in the lab is panicked about it. Nobody's reacting like, uh-oh, genetically modified spider on the loose. And so there's Peter just standing there, and the spider, unprovoked, comes down and crawls around on him while he's taking pictures. And it's on him for kind of a long time before it bites him randomly and then goes away. Again, unprovoked. Like, spiders bite you if you're doing something to them. They don't just, like, walk up to you and be like, bite, and then leave.
Well, maybe that's part of the genetic engineering, is that this spider is now an asshole.
Whatever. Like, that part I can forgive. But I'm sorry. I don't care how into somebody you are. If a giant spider lands on you and walks around, it does not take you until it bites you to notice it if you're awake. And you should be like, ah! Like, you should react like, spider!
Everyone's wearing long sleeves in this thing through the whole movie, so, like, if it had started on his sleeve and then crawled to his hand, totally viable. But, man, the second a spider touches your skin, not only, like, there's a bug on me, but for every moment after that, you're like, oh, now I'm covered in bugs.
And you're not all cool about it if it bites you, too. Like, I don't care how tough you are. You could be Joe Manganiello today. versus the, you know, less impressive version that's in this film, a spider lands on you and it bites you, you go, ah! Like, you make a noise that indicates, I've been bitten by a spider.
I mean, I don't know if I would...
Maybe you're a tough dude and you're like, oh!
No, I've been bitten by a lot of spiders in my day, and usually Lager. I don't notice the... Let me tell you.
You're disgusting.
I've been around.
What other bugs have bitten you?
Oh, don't get me started. But I usually do not notice the bite until after the bug has, you know, done the deed and been on its way, and then it's like, oh man, this hurts.
Because you're asleep.
Well, no, I mean, just today.
If a bug is biting you, you're like, I'm seeing a bug.
I see the bug, but it's not like, bite, ouch, there's a bug on me. It's like, bite, ouch.
It doesn't need to bite you.
Whatever.
If a big spider is on you.
Yes, I agree. He should have noticed the spider.
You go fling, and you go, eh.
The one thing I did like about that scene, though, is that they keep drilling into you how much Peter Parker is a coward and afraid to talk to this girl that he's been in love with for, like, 12 years or whatever.
Since he was 6 or in 4th grade, depending on who you talk to.
Well, they've known each other. Yeah, I guess that does
Maybe
get kind of...
Maybe he was 6 in 4th grade.
He does meet her when he's, like, 6 and thinks she's an angel, but also has been in love with her since 4th grade. So maybe it was more of a religious thing until 4th grade, and then it started getting more sexual for him as he matured. But
now that's a movie! I mean, you'd have to age them up for it not to be gross, but...
You know. Or age them down.
Ooh, yuck.
A story about some horny 4th graders... Who then become superheroes.
And you can tell because they immediately take up seamstressing.
Right. It's a handy skill to have. I mean, I think in this day and age where so many youth are into cosplay, it makes a little more sense to have all that costuming skill. But it's actually something I really love about the new Spider-Man was how functional his costume is, but it still looks very homemade. Whereas in this, it's like he has a bunch of shitty gym clothes or whatever, and then straight into the most impossible, like, I don't even know what material that,
yeah.
Like, some sort of...
There's no explanation for his suit upgrade.
It's the, like, most baffling shift. Like, I seriously can't think of what material that is, because it doesn't look like anything. It doesn't look like latex or...
I think I have a tote bag made out of it.
Maybe. Are you Spider-Man?
No, I'm not. Are we jumping? Can we stay here? Because
I feel like I was going to make a point before we started talking about when he fell in love with Mary Jane.
Yeah.
But now we're so far from it that I can't remember what it was. Oh, right. The thing I liked about the spider bite scene was they kept hitting you over the head with how he's a coward and won't talk to Mary Jane. And then the moment when he finally works up the nerve to talk to her and be like, can I take your picture for the school newspaper, then that causes him to back into the position to be bit by the spider. So had he never made that move to introduce himself and ask for the picture, then he would never have been bitten by the spider.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that little bit of interconnectedness, even if the spider itself doesn't make any sense.
Does that mean that you yourself are going to start being a little bit bolder in life now in the hopes that some sort of genetically modified bug will bite you in those moments?
No, as we've already established, I have no problem getting bugs to bite me. I think I can just continue going about my business and they'll have at it. Okay. And eventually one of them will be the one.
And then you'll be like, ooh, now I can take up seamstressing.
Well, I've already done that. I just, you know, it's good to be prepared.
Okay, so let's jump to the seamstressing thing then. Because the crack that I made to you during the film is that George Carlin has this bit about how pot is a gateway drug, but what the gateway leads to is carpentry, because once you take up marijuana, you want to turn everything into a bong. And that, I think, is a good equivalent for what happens in superhero-dom, where you're like, oh, now that I have developed superpowers or recognized that I have superpowers, I must... sew myself some kind of costume. And on the one hand, I thought that the movie handled it well, where he's like, oh, I'm going to go into amateur wrestling to make some money, so I have to put a costume together. And so he's got, like, a silkscreened t-shirt. He's got a very sophisticated bunch of doodles for a guy who doesn't have artistic talent is one of the characteristics people attribute to him.
We don't know that. I was wondering about that in the moment, like, if we were supposed to believe that he was also, as well as being an aspiring photographer, if he was also a sketch, some sort of sketch artist, you know, there seemed to be sketches on his wall, and I couldn't tell if those were also a product of this moment, or if that was supposed to be something that's just also part of his character.
So he's just well-rounded.
Yeah, he seems like he has a lot of time on his hands.
He does. Okay, so anyway, he's got a sketchbook full of really sophisticated drawings of what the costume could be, should be, what he wants his emblem to be, etc. So he goes from silk-screened mall-grade t-shirt and, you know, color-coordinated, like,
what are those? Ski mask and gloves.
Ski mask. Those look like the gloves that you wear when you're riding a motor, like a dirt bike. And he had on, like high-tops shoes. Yeah. And then the next day, he's wearing this, like, head-to-toe, skin-tight performance garb. Without, like, all the transition is he looks at his picture and he's like, And then he has it. There's no talk about where he got it, how he made it, how much it cost. And I was thinking of Supergirl, the TV show, where when she decides to come out with her powers, so to speak, there's, like, this whole big thing about making her friend win, help her come up with a functional costume. And there's iterations, there's, like, a whole trying on costumes montage. There's an explanation of him having special skills in this area. It's not like she just goes, and then has the iconic costume we know her having.
Right.
There's something to it. And in the new Spider-Man, it's like, oh, Tony Stark, billionaire science genius, has engineered this costume. But here there's this barely out of high school dork who's like, I'm going from my sweats and my t-shirt to super performance garb that I conjured out of thin air. Like, what the heck?
Somehow he already has more tailoring experience as a high school student than Mary Jane has acting experience. And well, that's like her whole thing.
You said he has time on his hands.
Yeah, that's the one element that I found very believable, is if there's any kid who's spending a lot of time drawing himself as a superhero, it's probably this version of Peter Parker.
Well, those are the three things that stood out to me the most this time that I was like, meh, no. Spider, upside down, rainy kiss with wet t-shirt contest, and instant costume.
There's a character in the comics in the Spider-Verse, as it's called, the many characters that have Spider-Man or Spider-Man-like powers. Her hero name is Silk, Cindy Moon, and she does naturally produce spider web out of her hands, and it's kind of gross, but also her costume is made of that, so, like, that could have been an interesting element if he was able to use his naturally occurring web to, you know, spin a costume like a spider or something. At least that seems more consistent with the concept than, yeah, he's really good with neoprene or whatever the hell this thing is made of.
Well, there is that period where he's just, like, shooting his webs all over his bedroom with the door closed and trying to keep his aunt
Yeah, there's
out,
a lot of, like, there's a lot of puberty antics going on here.
He's a teen boy in here, but, like, maybe he
raging hormones, as Uncle Ben says.
Yeah, maybe he harvested all of that expelled web to fashion himself a costume.
Like a silkworm.
Yeah. Alright, I buy that. Oh, another thing that's totally unrelated to what you were just talking about, but that I also enjoyed in this movie, is that Lucy Lawless is in it for a split second.
It was a surprising cameo.
Yeah. That's post-Xena Lucy Lawless. Like, why are you here, Lucy Lawless? What are you doing playing a two-line punk girl in Spider-Man? But good for you also.
Yeah. So, Oscorp, Norman Osborn's corporation, is developing what seems, I mean, I'm assuming were this tied into a cinematic universe or even a broader comic book universe at the time, that the gas that turns him into the Green Goblin would have been of an ilk with the super soldier serum that created Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that in the comics is, you know, because that's a recurring thing of all these other heroes and villains being created by people trying to replicate that experiment or replicate the results of that experiment. But as with many villains, he fails, it turns him schizophrenic, and gives him super strength. But the thing that really struck me was, like, there's this vindictive general who really wants to ruin Norman Osborn's company for some reason. I'm not sure what the relationship is there or why he hates him so much, but it felt so weird that anyone in the military-industrial complex would come to this meeting and be like, here, oh, we have this serum, this solution, whatever, that will make your soldiers super strong and resilient, and there is a side effect that will make them extremely violent and potentially insane. It seems odd that any representative of the military-industrial complex would be like, oh, you made a super soldier serum, and it has side effects of increased violence. Please start over completely or don't try at all. This sounds like a bad thing that we don't want to spend more money on. Like, there's so much ridiculous stuff that the military-industrial complex has poured billions of dollars into, whether good or bad, that, it just rang so false for this general to come in and be like, no, this isn't going to work out for us. Instead, we're going to go with this other company that's making a very silly-looking, dildo-shaped robot pod that will get blown up immediately. I did like that element of how stupid and ineffective that the competing robot thing was, but it did feel so oddly disjointed when they were like, hey, we have this armor suit and flying glider thing. It's pretty awesome as well. And they're like, no, we're 100% not interested in that. Show us the super soldier serum, or it's nothing at all. We're going to go buy this awful robot suit from the other guys, even though you seem to have various technologies that are far superior to it. It was really weird.
Well, what I thought you were going to say is that the follow-up to that is that the competing company, Oscorp is completely trouncing in terms of the contracts and profits and everything, makes a competitive bid to buy them, and the board of directors of Oscorp is like, we're going to go ahead and do this without talking to our founder, and then surprise him now that he's crazy and a supervillain.
That sounded like a business thing that I didn't understand.
Well, I understand business, and let me tell you, if you are a very successful and profitable company and you are trouncing another company that must buy, you know, it's just reasonable that they would no longer be as profitable, it's unlikely that that company's going to acquire you at that time and all your contracts, but also it's unlikely that the entire board of directors would be able to negotiate the whole sale and require your resignation as the founder of the company without you having an inkling or any time having passed. Like, you know, you walk into the meeting and you're like, guys, costs are down, profits are up, everything's rosy for our company. And they're like, oh yeah, we sold the company while you weren't looking. Also, you're fired.
It is very odd.
Yeah, the whole thing was, like, that felt lazy to me.
It's extra odd that the future of the company as a whole depended on this super soldier serum. Like, you have a huge corporation. You'd think you'd have diversified a little more beyond, well, we've got this glider, and we've got this super soldier serum, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-mm. The armor. They also have the body
true,
armor.
True, the armor. And I did like, I thought it was funny that the guy they show testing the armor and the glider suit has this weird, like, Chronicles of Riddick, like, over the top of the head visor thing, and he has his head shaved. It all seemed like they put this test pilot through a lot just to test this stupid glider when Norman Osborn takes the glider and becomes the Green Goblin. He has a custom-made evil goblin mask instead. I thought that was all very odd and very funny.
Well, you know, he gets some superpowers and immediately is into cosplay and costumery.
They do establish, at least, that he's super into evil-looking masks.
He has a whole house full of creepy masks.
So he had plenty of inspiration. It's just a little curious that he also had the means to either secretly or already have this Green Goblin flight suit mask made.
Yeah, the fabrication on that, like, he's like, one minute I'm getting my superpowers, and the next minute I have a fully realized costume. You know what? That must be how it works in their universe. This is
definitely before the era of 3D printers, too, so I wonder if, like, the scientist that he killed, when he takes the super soldier serum, it seems like he's having a seizure and dying, so his scientist friend, who, even though he was against this whole project to begin with, is the one person to help him undergo this procedure when he's trying to resuscitate him. Norman wakes up and strangles him and throws him through some stuff and I guess kills him. So maybe he then went to, like, the armor fabrication area and was like, hey, we have this new plan for one helmet. I'd like you guys to whip it up. And once they do, then he strangles them and throws them through some shelves and kills them.
We're really helping fill in some holes here.
Well, they need to be filled, because the movie's not going to do it for us.
It isn't.
Instead, the movie will give us a Macy Gray concert where Spider-Man leaps off of a Balloon Man Rastafarian guy to save Mary Jane, who is wearing a Chinese dress at the, what the heck is the name of the celebration?
The Unity Festival.
Isn't it? It's like the Global Unity Festival. It's something very real and believable. World Unity Day, where Mary Jane wears a Chinese dress to celebrate World Unity Day. And there's a really, really odd bit in that where Green Goblin classically has pumpkin bombs to fit the motif of a goblin, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, they're more sci-fi looking, you know, to fit the military-industrial complex motif. And most of them are just bombs. A couple he throws at Spider-Man split up into, like, batarang robot blade knives, boomerang things. And one of them, only one ever through the entire movie, he throws at the board of directors and it turns them into skeletons.
Yeah, but they were so familiar. Didn't those skeletons look familiar to you? Like, that whole effect?
It looked like the blade skeletons.
That's why it looked so familiar.
Yeah, I was like, I wonder if those guys are vampires too.
Probably.
Corporate vampires. Bloodsuckers for sure.
Whoa.
Although that's technically an anti-Semitic remark, so I take it back.
Okay.
Something I kept noticing in this was all the Superman references, which both, like, homages visually and, you know, up and away, you know, like, straight-up Superman lines. I thought, I wonder if any of that would happen in a Marvel movie now that there's such this clear delineation and ongoing competition between DC movies and Marvel movies for them to even obliquely reference the existence of one another. Like, someone even says, I think Aunt May even says at one point to Peter, you're not Superman, dear. Right.
Yeah. What homages to Superman are you referencing?
That.
Just when that he says and, up and away and when she says that?
Yeah.
Because I really felt like the whole scene, there's the whole scene where the Roosevelt Island gondola?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, so
Cable car thing?
Like, cable gondola car off thing. Street. Okay, so where the Green Goblin is making Spider-Man choose whether he's going to save Mary Jane or a gondola full of children.
Right.
And he's doing both. And there were so many visual callbacks to the Superman movies from the early 80s. Like, where there's a school bus going off a bridge after the earthquake in the original Superman movie. And everything about, like, that was so evocative of that moment.
Also, I guess that scene where he's swinging around the city with her in his arms, that had some of that going on, too.
That's got to be on purpose.
I liked that gondola scene, though, because it felt sort of self-referential in a way that wasn't, like, snarky or too for the Green Goblin to be like, I'm a villain and I'm going to put you in this impossible situation. Doesn't that suck? Isn't that super typical of a villain thing to do? Like, I liked him recognizing that and Spider-Man still subverting it in a very typical way. But, you know, it's that sort of dramatic thing that they like to... It reminded me a lot of the stupid two-boat sequence in The Dark Knight where Joker puts bombs on two boats in some body of water in New York, Gotham, and one of the boats is filled with convicts and the other is filled with not convicted civilians, and the civilians want to blow up the convicts, and the convicts are like, no, I think Tiny Lister is in this scene, and he's like, even though we've all been convicted of crimes and are under the boot of this authoritarian country, we're not going to blow up those innocent white people. And then Batman breaks laws and punches people or something. I don't know. But
anyway,
it was the sort of like heavy-handed self-congratulatory bullshit in that movie that felt a lot more knowing but still sincere in this movie.
Another moment that stood out for me in this was the first interaction that the Green Goblin and Spider-Man have after their battle of the balloon people is the Green Goblin kidnaps Spider-Man, takes him to a rooftop to pitch him, like, let's work together.
We're not so different, you and I. Yeah. He literally says that.
He has unconscious Spider-Man on this rooftop for an indeterminate amount of time and does not mess with his mask at all.
It is a weird thing.
It's a weird thing. Like, he spends all this time trying to figure out who Spider-Man is, but he's got him there prone. Like, he could take the mask off in that moment, and he doesn't. And having just rewatched the season finale of season 6 of Game of Thrones, where Cersei Lannister is like, hey, all my enemies, go in this room. Now I have blown you up without explaining myself to you. And I'm like, that is what a villain should do. They should just be villainous instead of always being like, listen, I'm super evil, but, you know, just to a point. Just so that you're going to be able to operate safely within your parameters.
I can sort of buy it as a character turn in that he's not, like, obsessed with Spider-Man at this point, because we only see him being curious about who Spider-Man is for the 10 seconds before Spider-Man shows up and he knocks him unconscious. So it's not like he's been pulling his hair out trying to find the Spider, you know, J.K. Simmons, but J. Jonah Jameson.
Same diff.
Right. He's more obsessed with who Spider-Man is than the Green Goblin up to this point, but... So I could see Green Goblin just being more curious than angry or obsessed. He seems to genuinely think that he has something to offer this guy. And there's always, you know, the tropey thing of, oh, this guy's mentally unwell, so who knows how consistent his motivations need to be at any given time. But it is still odd, you know, that he wouldn't pull off his mask. But they don't dwell, I kind of like that they don't dwell on the mystery of who Spider-Man is in the villain conflict too much, because it's almost immediately after this that he just figures it out, which, come on, Spider-Man. So, Green Goblin lures Spider-Man into a burning building, throws some goblin batarangs at him, one of them cuts Spider-Man's arm, Goblin observes this after this conflict, it's... Like, this is all happening on Thanksgiving.
Apparently.
Well, maybe that's how the building burned down. Someone burned their turkey.
No, Green Goblin burned the building.
I don't know.
It was a trap.
I mean, he got there. He used it as a trap, but I don't know if he burned the building down.
It was a trap.
I don't know how that baby got out alive. That's one thing.
Yeah, and it was a real baby. I was so expecting it to be a cat. But, like, okay, if you have a baby, you don't leave it in your upper floor apartment all by itself while you go hang out in New York. I don't think that's a real thing.
You also...
Like, oh, my baby's still up there in the burning building and I just got back from wherever I've been.
Yeah, well, even if she... Like, there's no circumstance where that really makes any sense. Either the baby was with someone and that person should have taken the baby out, or she was with the baby and she left it there to escape herself.
No, that was lame.
And then the baby comes out and it's not sooty at all. It's not having any, it's just, it's fine.
Yeah, but the Green Goblin is in there dressed in, like, a tablecloth or something waiting for him, which tells me it was a trap.
I mean, I could definitely buy that, but it could also have been like, oh, Green Goblin showed up here too and was like, might as well fight him in this burning down. Okay,
I'm right.
You're right.
I'm right. Okay, thanks.
I felt like I was... Oh, right. So he cuts his arm. Then both of them leave this burning building to go to Peter and Harry's loft for Thanksgiving dinner. And Peter gets there after Norman. But he swings into his room and they hear him kind of thump his way in. They're like, oh, let's go investigate that noise. We didn't think Peter was here. And he's hiding on the ceiling and he drips a glob of gooey spider blood onto the ground. And Norman notices it. He knows something is up.
Like, that is the tallest blob of blood I have ever seen. It looks like a giant ketchup dot.
That is definitely Spider-Man blood.
That is blood that I'm looking at and not, radioactive, like, red puppy
spider
paints.
Blood.
Yeah.
So...
Not radioactive. Genetically modified.
I guess. Well, who knows?
Who knows?
So, Peter was supposed to bring cranberry sauce to...
It looked like cranberry sauce.
Sure.
He brought the cranberry sauce. What?
He literally brings a cranberry sauce, though. He then shows up, and it's like, man, you had time to go grab that cranberry sauce, but not a fucking Band-Aid for your cut-up arm. Mm. So, of course, once he sits down at the table, everyone notices his arm is bleeding, and Norman puts it together immediately. I cut that arm. I saw that blood on the floor upstairs. This guy's Spider-Man. I'm gonna go crazy somewhere else. I'm out of here, but first I need to... yell a bunch of misogynist stuff about my dork son's girlfriend loud enough for everyone inside to hear. Good thing they didn't close the door. We didn't close the door on our way out, so no one would hear our very insulting conversation.
Here's the thing about that cranberry sauce. The reason that he had time to get that and not a Band-Aid is because he knew he had to get the cranberry sauce, so he picked that up ages before this. And he had that and the suit of clothes that he comes in the house in, in nature's pocket.
That was...
And then he retrieved them. But he didn't have a Band-Aid because he didn't know he would need one.
That was a thing. Another thing I was wondering about in the upside-down kiss scene was that the alleys of New York are littered with creepers hiding in the shadows, and the rooftops are littered with Spider-Man's clothes because he's just continually stripping them off and throwing them wherever as he runs across the rooftops.
Oh, he's so careless with clothes.
Which was actually a funny element of the new Spider-Man movie where he's always trying to web, like he, you know, packs all his stuff in a backpack and webs it to a ceiling somewhere to keep it safe, but is still losing the backpacks every time. So I like that acknowledging of it. But this, it was like, man, how many shoes does this guy go through when he's just... throwing them on whatever rooftop as he sprints to a crime.
You raise, you give us a good transition segue here because I wanted to make the point that one of the things that was so beautiful and noticeable in the new Spider-Man movie was the diversity of the cast. That, like, all the way through, there's diversity. And, I mean, unfortunately, there's still a lot of white right up at the top tier of the cast, but, like, it's, like, immediately below that, it gets multicolored, and that is so refreshing. This was a white movie.
Yeah, the main cast in this is all white. Like, at least the extras seemed like actual New York extras, but anyone aside, like, Octavia Spencer and one of the guys at the newspaper, their teacher, and Macy Gray, it was like, you got, like... I don't know.
There was an Asian woman as a scientist.
Right.
I mean, there was... it's not like it was pure white.
No.
It's not like the episode of Leave It to Beaver I watched while I was working out this morning. But it was...
It's not the whitest depiction of New York I've ever seen. But it, as far as characters with names and agency within the plot...
Like, that's one of the things that's so good about the high school and the new one is that it's like... It is a rainbow of a high school, and this was far less rainbow. Like, again, it's not like there isn't a single person of color on screen in the whole thing, but the difference was really noticeable in a way where I was like, way to go, new movie. Another thing, what about that Bechdel test?
Well, aside from, like, Mary Jane and that scientist you mentioned, I can't even... Oh.
Mary Jane has two female friends who don't get names, and there are a couple of scenes where Mary Jane and Aunt May are in the room. Yeah, that's what I was trying to think,
if they ever talk to each other.
They're women with names, but they don't really talk to each other. Like, maybe at the Thanksgiving scene, they say something like, thanks.
I don't even think they speak to each other at that. It's mostly just everyone being like, what's Norman's deal? He's losing it.
Yeah. But, so, I'm going to give it a fail, which is a bummer. But you said I was going
to
be failing a lot of these.
I mean, if they did talk to each other in that scene, it was either about Norman or Harry. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. So, sorry you couldn't have had more diversity of every description film.
It was, you know, decent.
I think you got it right when you said it was all right. I mean... You know, like we were saying about the original X-Men movie, it is difficult to judge it objectively through the lens of it being 15 years old and mm-hmm. us having seen so much more since then. So it's hard to say what aspects of it were super derivative and which aspects were fresh then, which aspects were troublesome then and troublesome now.
Mm-hmm.
And which ones have just, like, you know, times has changed, so some things are going to be more noticeable today than they were then.
Yeah, I'd say more light misogyny and homophobia than you would get from a modern superhero, or a modern Marvel movie.
Where was the homophobia?
The thing that stuck out to me was the... amateur wrestling fight when he's fighting Bonesaw. He leaps up onto the cage and is hiding up there, and Bonesaw's like, "Ooh, come down here." And he's like, "That's a nice costume. Did your husband pick it out for you?" Or something like that.
Yeah.
And that gets Bonesaw real steamed because Bonesaw isn't gay. Hmm. I'm hetero, dude.
Okay, good catch. You're so good at... You have such a good sensitivity to, you know, things.
I'm very sensitive.
You are.
I'm a soft boy.
No, you're just a millennial.
Same difference. Another little thing that I thought was weird. Kind of seemed like those cops just let Uncle Ben die. Like, the one cop, she's like, paramedics are on the way, but... this old dude's just lying there bleeding out. It's not like anyone's putting pressure on those wounds or applying first aid or something. You know, you'd think they would have some sort of rudimentary bandages in their squad cars.
No, not back then.
And even then, like, once he, like, he takes his own pressure off the wound to say his final words to Pete.
It's like, Peter.
Yeah, it's, I think this old dude could have been saved if anyone cared. If anyone was doing their job.
No, I think the message was pretty clear that nobody cared. Everybody, like, he died, and everybody's like, well, you know, he was unemployed, he didn't really know what to do with himself.
That's true.
Let's move on. That guy was ripe for being murdered.
That's that also was a thing that played into the subtle theme of corporate malfeasance, of this old man being replaced by automation. Now he just has to putter around home until he gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
We should all be so lucky.
And Aunt May is like, I'm crying into your arms, Peter, but also we only miss him that one time at graduation.
You seem to miss him a lot more than I do, Peter. Peter cries a lot, and I think we only see Aunt May cry that one time.
Well, she's a stoic person.
True. She's probably, yeah, she's been around him for, you know, probably like 50 years longer than Peter.
She's
if
good.
Anyone's tired of his shit, it's her.
Yeah, she's good.
I don't know if there's anything well, I guess we should cover the end of the movie, which is that Spider-Man saves the cable car gondola thing and then gets Bolo lassoed by Green Goblin and tossed into some weird, like, abandoned brick building. And they have a scuffle. Spider-Man seems to be getting the crap kicked out of him until Green Goblin makes a thinly veiled rape threat against Mary Jane, and then Spider-Man's like, "Oh, you dare threaten the girl I like?" And his rage builds, and he fights back, and then Green Goblin is hoisted by his own petard, by which I mean he tries to stab Spider-Man with the knives that come out of his glider, but Spider-Man dodges it, and instead they stab Green Goblin.
You know what's funny is that when it happened, I thought he's been hoisted by his own petard.
Yeah. It's a little known fact. Petard means robot glider.
I thought you were going to say a real fact just then. I was like, you know, nautical facts?
I knew what petard meant, but I forgot. Either way, it's something you wouldn't expect. Like, the phrase isn't as intuitive as it seems.
I mean, its use works,
but, like, I don't think most people... I feel like it's, like, a sword blade term or something like that.
Hoist with his own petard is a Shakespearean idiom from Hamlet, meaning to cause the bomb maker to be petard, blown up with his own bomb.
Okay, yeah.
A petard is a small bomb used for blowing up gates and walls when breaching fortifications.
Yeah, they're like those old-fashioned grenades.
I have always thought it meant, like, being hoisted up on... a mast, like a captain being hoisted
There's lots of ways that it seems like you can imagine what it means, and none of them are right. It's about throwing a little bomb, but accidentally blowing yourself up. And you know who has petards? Green Goblin.
The Green Goblin. He bona fide was hoisted by his own petard, except for, you know, in this case, not.
He could have been, though.
He could have been. They missed an opportunity there. Maybe they, like me, mistook that for a nautical saying. They didn't see the opportunity.
And he dies with his final words, the recurring motif, in case I haven't said that word too many times in this episode.
You haven't.
Don't tell Harry.
That you've said too many times.
That they've said too many times. Because no one wants to tell Harry anything, and honestly, understandable.
Yeah, he seems like kind of a petulant drip. You know, he's got a lot of insecurities, and what I've decided the older I get is that people who have a lot of insecurities make their own misery. That's what his character seems like.
He also seems like kind of a doofus, though, so even if you did try to have a serious conversation with him about anything, it doesn't seem like it would go anywhere. I think far too few people in this day and age are being hoisted by their own petards.
You know, I hope I haven't said this too many times during this episode, but don't tell Harry.
You know what would happen if you did tell him? He'd hoist himself by his own petard.
More than likely.
I think maybe that's actually how Spider-Man 3 ends. he tries to make a heroic sacrifice by hoisting himself with his own petard.
I think that is how it ends, now that I remember I've seen it. Probably that, or like, Topher Grace is like...
hoist that petard my way.
He's like, groovy.
Right.
Join us next time for Daredevil.